Hi, and welcome to Watch Next, the podcast where we recommend what you should watch next. I'm Dr. Ruby Sanchez-Lozoya. Each episode, join me in a conversation with fascinating scholars and thinkers to explore world cinema in a way that feels warm, inviting, and completely jargon-free. In today's episode, bookseller Moctezuma Sett González joins us to talk about Whisper of the Heart. Moctezuma Sett González is a used and antiquarian bookseller. He's the owner of Libra Books in Austin, Texas. Since we will be discussing the film in detail throughout the episode, consider this your spoiler reminder. And with that, let's begin. Sett, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
What is the day like of a bookseller before doing media appearances?
It changes every single day. Today, I went to the store and I was removing books that have been there for a while and putting in new books. I have like a whole bargain section.
Mm.
And I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that most of the bargain books were ones that I had recently put in for like the last few months or so. But it varies. Like sometimes I spend time in my warehouse where there's like 1,000 small tasks to do.
Right.
Sometimes it's looking at somebody's book collection. On Monday, I went to go look at this philosophy professor's book collection.
Nice.
Sometimes it's, you know, being introduced to a customer who's going to sell you your books. Each library that I buy involves different levels of interaction. There was one library that was shown to me, but I didn't buy it yet because they're not ready to sell. And
okay.
So at that point, it was just like me talking about me and books. And it lasted about 2 hours or so, just me talking with this guy. And funny enough, this doesn't always happen, but I brought up another book collection that I had acquired from this guy who was like Nixon's lawyer during Watergate.
Wow.
And the guy's name is Charles Allen Wright. And I mentioned that name to them and immediately they're like, we know who that is. The lady who was the wife of the guy whose book collection I was looking at was the law student of this guy, Charles Allen Wright.
Oh, wow.
He taught at UT. The intramural fields are named after him.
Wow.
And I was just telling them about the fascinating book collection that this man had and acquired over the span of his life. And so that just kind of like led down a path of like 40 minutes of more conversation.
Yeah.
So sometimes there's that. Sometimes it's just like talking to people, which is very enjoyable. Like that's one of the things that I've kind of always wanted to like spend a good portion of my life,
yeah,
you know, to like just chatting with people or discussing ideas, talking about stories and lived experience.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you said that because this is exactly what we'll do today. So It's a good way of like getting us to think about the film. I was actually quite nervous about this selection because this is the one that I feel less certain about. When I was thinking of the selection for you, because you have one of the best collections, if not the best collection of books in Austin by Mexican and Latin American and Spanish authors, the first thing that came to mind was adaptations. So I thought of Like Water for Chocolate and Loving the Times of Cholera. That's have you seen those films? Have you seen those adaptations?
Loving the Time of Cholera, I think I have seen. It's been probably well over a decade since I saw it. And then Water for Chocolate. I saw that film about maybe 15 years ago, but then I saw it recently, maybe about 3 years ago. So that one's a little bit more fresher on my mind.
So that's what I thought would happen. I had the feeling that you would have seen them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Then, okay. And then you said that you wanted to talk about an animation and you're the second person to request an animation. So it was like, okay, now is the time to talk about an animated film. That opened up like a world of possibilities, especially with Japanese animation. I was thinking of Akira and Paprika. And then this lovely film is called 5 Centimeters per Second. And they're all very visually striking. They're gorgeous. And they really push the boundary of filmmaking. And especially because you said that you were very interested in avant-garde and art house films. Mm-hmm. I thought those would be like really good selections for you. But what really brought us to this film is because more than anything else, I wanted to talk to you about books mm-hmm. and about collecting. Oh, and because the other thing that I thought it was really nice about the film is about origin stories. And I'm really curious about your origin stories. How does one become a bookseller? Mm-hmm. So what do you think of the film?
I love the film. And I really appreciate that you suggested that one. Frankly, the first word that kind of comes to mind is cozy.
Yes.
Which I didn't anticipate. You know, I love that it was about books. And I love that there was this kind of like moment of trying to find the, I don't know, like the lineage of a book being checked out. And so she was like really interested in that. It ended up being not as mystical or mysterious mm-hmm. or magical as she thought, but it led her down another path. And I love that, you know, because I deal with that a lot. Whenever I buy somebody's book collection, they're usually dead at this point. By the time that I get there and I look at everything and I buy everything. And even whenever I go to the person's house and I'm dealing with, you know, their loved ones who are like letting go of this book collection, I don't get a sense of who the person was until I start going through it by myself in my warehouse or, you know, wherever I have a set of the books. And then you start making connections. Obviously, whenever you can look at the titles and kind of get a sense of their general interest, but you really learn more about their lives through the ephemera that's inside.
Wow.
Like little slips, little receipts, drawings, notations. Sometimes you see, you know, mail, you know, just like mail in between pages. They use it as a bookmark or whatever. And it would be like, I don't know. I'm thinking right now of this very fascinating character. He worked for the Texas Department of Transportation and funny enough, didn't drive. He didn't have a car.
That's great.
He hated like vehicles.
Uh-huh.
And so he would walk everywhere. And he was like a really eccentric guy. He had like a PhD in mathematics from UT. He worked as like a software systems engineer for like the Texas Department of Transportation. But he didn't have a laptop. He didn't have a computer at home. He didn't do any of his coding digitally.
Uh-huh.
He would print out massive sheets of code. Uh-huh. And just like, that's how he did his work.
Wow.
So I don't know. I don't understand the intricacies of how those systems run, but I got to see different facets of this guy. It's really fascinating to see. You don't always get that though with every book collection that you acquire. Like the one that I went to go see on Monday, I just got remnants of the book collection. I didn't get it as somebody had already come and bought a lot of the books. I think
couple
had like, they were downsizing, they're moving.
So it's like a fragmented story.
Yeah, it's a fragmented story, yeah. And so I didn't get a full picture of who he was. There are a few books here and there, like there was one on, I don't know what the Japanese word for it is, but it's like bondage, like sex bondage.
Yeah, no, I don't know what that is.
And there were a few books on that and on like sadomasochism. And
he's the same guy who was the student of the lawyer of Nixon?
No, this is another guy.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they all kind of start to blend in together.
I see.
Yeah, or at least in my mind, they kind of melt together. Who knows how the memory of these people will be, you know, 40, 50 years from now. But
this is fascinating for a number of reasons. And I have so many follow-up questions. How did you know that the guy didn't drive?
So his sister was the one that was dealing with the estate.
Uh-huh.
And she did tell me that. So she let me know a few details here and there, which always helps, you know. But then I saw like little things that I don't think his sister knew.
Uh-huh.
Like certain books that are like very different from the rest of the collection.
Yeah.
Like usually a handful of books, and they're usually like sexual in nature.
Uh-huh.
And I got to see that part of, you know, this gentleman. So you do get to see that side of people's lives. Sometimes they're very open about it.
Yeah.
If they're not dead. Like there was this guy who runs this company, this estate sale company that I know, and he sold me his books, But he was very open about the books, and he's kind of a funny guy, and they were all sexual in nature.
Wow. I think this is actually very fitting for this film because it's a Studio Ghibli film. So just to remind the listeners, Whisper of the Heart is a Studio Ghibli 1995 Japanese animated film. It was directed by Yoshifumi Kondo, and it was written by Hayao Miyazaki. The film follows 14-year-old Chizuko, a voracious reader who discovers that all her library books have been previously checked out by the same boy, Seiji Amasawa, who aspires to become a violin maker. Whisper of the Heart is a coming-of-age story about chasing your passions, discovering who you are, and experiencing the quiet beginnings of young love at a time when everything feels new, hopeful, and full of possibility. And the reason I say that it matches is because, contrary to the description that I just gave, a Studio Ghibli film feels very different from Pixar because sometimes it deals with darker subjects or heavier subjects. Mm-hmm. And I think especially Japanese animation, it doesn't shy away from portraying the darker things in life, the sexual things in life. And so even though this is a cozy film, is perhaps a good way of thinking of the diversity within Ghibli films. Mm-hmm. I was very fascinated by how you are not only collecting the actual books of people, but also collecting the stories. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder what, if you have always been this way, it's like, were you always interested in people's stories, or what was it that brought you to books? Is it the stories of people? Is it stories in general?
I do think the stories in general, I think, always touch everybody.
Mm.
I can't figure out why or know why, but there's just something that, there's a reason why people love watching films. There's a reason why people love reading the books that they read. There's a reason why certain kinds of narrative radio programs or podcasts are so popular, because they have that, there's something about story that's just like, very human. But for me, I think that there was always this allure towards the forbidden or the unknown.
Uh-huh.
I remember whenever my parents and I moved, and my siblings moved to the house that we lived in, I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and there was a massive bookcase that was right at the entrance of the house. At this point, I don't think the current or the people that were living there before had completely moved out. And I got to see their house before they moved out. And there were two very strange rooms that I found. One was the garage, which had a bunch of shelves with the sticky, gooey material inside of jars.
Mm-hmm.
And it just looked black. It was just completely black. One of them fell, or at least I don't remember the memory of it too much, but one fell and I found out it was like peaches.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what made me think that it was sweet. I must have tried it, or I don't know what it was, or maybe my dad told me. I don't remember. And then the other room was a small room in the barn in the back of the house that was filled with roses, but dried roses and dried rose thorns. Mm-hmm. Like just the thorns, and it was just jam-packed with the thorns, and I don't know why I remember that so vividly. And then I guess the third thing that kind of brings me back to the bookcase is I wondered who these people were for some reason, and I climbed to the top of the bookcase in hopes of finding a book that would reveal something to me about them or the house, or you know, just something that nobody else knew. And I don't know, there's always that desire to want to know the unknown or the forbidden, at least for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what got me into books. I mean, my mom read to me when I was like a child. And I think there's just something about knowledge that I was always kind of attracted to. I mean, I read a lot growing up. You know, I think the memory that I have closest to my interaction with books was at 14, 15, whenever I was being introduced to like Thoreau and Emerson and all these guys. And I mean, I've obviously read stuff in between, but it wasn't until I encountered these guys at that age that I sought to read more deeply and understand things more deeply. And there was a teacher who left out free books outside of her classroom. Funny enough, she sold books on Amazon. I didn't realize that until many years later. But she would always have this box of free books. And I got like my first copies of like Descartes. And I was reading Descartes like at 14, 15. I didn't understand most of it, but I got, you know, some ideas from there. There was another little essay called As a Man Thinketh. It was like, it was a, that specific copy I think was printed in 1896. And to me, it just felt like this is an old book, right? It has like this arcane knowledge or like this mystical knowledge or this, maybe not mystical, but like this something that others just don't have. And I want to understand it and I want to read it. And now today, a book from 1896, like I run into them daily.
Wow.
That's not like something that's, you know, special. But I did read that book and it did feel like it was special. This is written by this guy, James Allen. I just wanted to know more about the world that wasn't immediately available. I don't want to say that I only read books because I wanted to gain something from them. There's something else there. And I don't know what to put my, how to, what exactly to point at.
As you were speaking, it reminded me of like of many things. One is, why is it so important to foster, especially in young children, the desire to read and the joy of reading? Especially if you're a precocious reader, to me, it's one of the most important things to foster. I was a precocious reader. When I was in high school, right in front of my high school, we had a public library and I read The Divine Comedy. So The Inferno, The Paradise and Purgatory. I did not understand it. Like I read it. Like I did the act of like word and then another word and then continue reading. But did I get it? No. Did I get the metaphors? No. Were there many footnotes? Yes. I went through them. Did not help, right? But it really felt like a sense of accomplishment at like 15 to read something that was supposed to be one of the classics that you have to read, that everybody's talking about. You were part of the larger conversation. You were part of that canon. You were able to see yourself in conversation with authors from like different times, different parts of the world. And I haven't read it since, but because once is enough. But it felt like it was me touching into something bigger and larger. And it just made me want to like find more. So that really reminded me of what you were saying. And I'm wondering too, like in the film, who do you identify most with? The girl, Chitsugu, who wants to become a writer, or the boy who wants to become a violin maker, or the collector, because they meet in this antique shop.
I definitely identify more with the protagonist, Shizuku. So when I was 14 or 15, I also wrote a very bad story of like... It was about this man who was like mysterious, and he like at some point in his youth had a relationship with a girl in his school, but they drifted apart and he was now lost, successful, but now lost. And he then finds out that he had like a child with this love of his that he had whenever he was much younger, and he didn't know he had a daughter. And he randomly meets the daughter and they get along. And it was just really, really badly written. And so it reminded me whenever she wrote her novel and was just completely destroyed. Whenever, who was it, the collector who like reviewed it or somebody reviewed it. And they were like, it was a great first attempt. And she was just devastated. But once you pass that moment of devastation, you get this like, reassurance that you can do better and you want to keep doing it. And so after I was, when I was 14, 15, I was completely convinced that I was going to be able to write a novel by the time I was 18. I don't know why in my mind. And I would tell people too, oh, I'm working on the novel, you know? It was such a weird, you know, thing for me to have said. And it was going to be like a romance novel. I don't even know why I was thinking of this at that time. But yeah, so I really resonated with her character a lot more. And then obviously the kind of affinity towards books and the trying to find connection, not so much of what's inside the book, but of its past ownership.
Mm-hmm.
I started thinking about the library cards that yes. would be inside the book and how there's not, you wouldn't find that anymore.
Yeah.
Like nobody stamps on it. I mean, they yeah. might still be there, but it's like vestigial now at this yes. point. And, but yeah, it's unfortunate that part of the book is now completely taken away. And then there was like a moment in the film where the father was like, oh, you know, they're going to do away with the catalog system.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought this up because there's a level of coziness to the story. There's a little bit of like this coming of age, working very hard to get them, having your first crush. But it's also about the analog and the digital.
Yeah.
I think there's so much more about books, like you were saying. Something is the story that is within it, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also the stories of how we get there, the stories of how the book travels, and then all this memorabilia that is around the book or the little piece of paper, like you mentioned, that are left with the book, but also the marginalia. Mm-hmm. Like one thing that we lose now by not having physical books is the ability to write on the pages. It's one of my favorite things to do when I get a used book is to see what people have written. Mm-hmm. I hope they do it more in pencil than with pen because the things yeah. that people write and yeah. highlighting, but it's also very funny that like after the third chapter, the writing goes less and less.
Yeah.
Once
yeah.
you get to where the ending is basically nothing.
Yeah.
But is that something else that you find interesting when you're going through and browsing through old books?
Yeah. Right now when you were talking, I was thinking about a specific copy of, I think it's Ficciones by Borges. The person who was reading it absolutely hated it.
I love those.
and he's basically, I think there was a female name on there, but she was just calling him like misogynist or, you know, this and that. And I haven't read Ficciones, so I don't know what she's referring to. But whenever I will eventually read that specific copy.
Yes.
I want to know what she was thinking or what was going through her. What she was reading whenever she decided to like write that. And then there's another copy of 100 Years of Solitude that also was annotated. But this one was just like not in agreement or disagreement or anything because it's just a story. But she's like reacting to like some very gross moments when there's like obvious relationships between like younger girls and older men.
Mm.
And she's just like gross.
Yeah.
And I would just laugh and I was like, yeah, it's fucking yeah. gross.
Yeah.
And so that copy was like really pleasant to read. But I love that because it feels like you're reading it with somebody too.
Yes.
You know, they're engaged with the text as well.
Yeah.
And I, one thing I do hate though is highlighting.
Yes.
I hate highlighting.
It looks so ugly.
It's ugly and it's also very distracting.
Yes. And then it's also, to me, what is very annoying is when it's in what I think is the wrong part of the book. It's like, why are you highlighting this? This really was not that interesting or that good for you to be highlighting it. When I was preparing for my exams, I would write against the other marginalia. It's like, you're wrong. You know, it was very fun to do.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But so how do you, as a young novelist, how do you go from there to then become a bookseller?
Yeah, it really kind of started from a desire to abandon everything that I was doing at the time and focus on wanting to write again.
Mm-hmm.
That's what brought me to bookselling. I wanted to like spend more time writing. I was wanting to become an architect at the time that I was like about to start bookselling, and I was taking courses, and then the pandemic happened and it basically forced me to reevaluate what I was doing with my life because everybody had more time to like contemplate and just like be at home. And I didn't have Instagram at the time. I didn't have any social media that kept me distracted. I think I had abandoned Twitter at that point too. And so all I really had to do was, you know, be with myself. And at that time I met a bunch of booksellers.
Mm-hmm.
This didn't happen in isolation. It happened in a community of booksellers here in Austin. I was going to bookstores around Austin, specifically Recycled Reads, but I would also go to like all the Goodwills and all the thrift shops. And I would see the same guys just buying books, or like this team of Turkish booksellers,
wow.
these incredible ladies who are like the most vicious competition I've ever had. But I respect them, you know, game respects game. But anyway, I saw what they were doing and just asked them questions like, what are you guys doing? I'm curious, because whenever you go to a bookstore, people have a tendency to move in one singular way. Like there's a pattern of their movement, which is slow and deliberate. With these booksellers, they're moving fast.
Wow.
Very, very fast. And it seemed off the level of movement that they had compared to others. And it just, you know, I was wondering why. And eventually I found out that what they were doing. And I thought to myself, oh, you know, I know books,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think I could do the same thing. And so I started selling books on eBay and Amazon and wherever I could sell them online. I didn't have a website or anything like that. I wasn't selling them in my backyard, which at some point I started doing that. And I just kind of started being at bookstores or used bookstores a lot, or thrift shops, just trying to find another book to sell online. And often you would sell things that you don't particularly care about, because you're not always going to find books that you know or that you're interested in. You're going to find a book about, you know, best 100 low-calorie recipes.
Uh-huh.
But at that particular moment, it's selling for $30, you know? And so here it is for $2, you could make a profit. Mm. And I did that for about 2 years. That part of that history of my book selling is a part of my history that I didn't have a deep connection with book selling. It was just more a money-making operation, being able to sustain, pay for rent. I thought that that would allow me more time to write.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't. It didn't allow for more time to write. I fooled myself in thinking that it would, just being around books. But it was being around the right books that would inspire me to then focus on reading and writing. And so then after about 2 years of selling that way, I pivoted toward rare books.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to deal with books that were a lot more interesting. And I made this, like, it's hard to kind of see it, you know, see the history of it. It just, you know, happened incrementally over days, weeks, months. But I slowly started learning about different booksellers. And then after, like, you know, being interested in this field, I went to this thing called CABS,
mm-hmm.
which it's called the Colorado Antiquarian Bookselling School, or Bookseller
uh-huh.
School. Fascinating program.
Uh-huh.
And I got to meet booksellers that operate differently. Like, each one has their way of operating. There's one guy who is a professor there. Now he's the director of CABS. His name's Garrett Scott. One of the most fascinating characters I've ever met in my life. He was a guy who went to Stanford, studied history, wanted to become a poet, and somehow ended up doing bookselling.
Uh-huh.
I don't know the complete history of how he developed into a bookseller, but I think there is a grain of similarity between a lot of these antiquarian booksellers. And it is an intrigue of ideas, literature, books as material objects.
Mm-hmm.
And his take on bookselling is so unique. He loves to smell the book, and he gets to understand the book at that, you know, molecular level,
mm-hmm.
by its scent. It's also funny because I feel like somebody could draw a cartoon of him, and he has a very characteristic nose that pairs well with his desire to, like, smell the book.
Yeah.
He's a funny guy. He's a very smart guy. He's a very diligent researcher. Every bookseller has a different path, and my path was, you know, wanting to deal with more interesting material and wanting to get back to writing, get back to reading.
Thinking about this league of antiquarian booksellers, and I'm thinking of the owner of the antique shop in the film.
Mm.
I wonder how much of an overlap it is in terms of, like, looking at objects like as books in, and like antique shops and vintage shops.
Mm-hmm.
If if you were to be in a convention, what would be like the different cliques that they would like, you know, fight against and but also join them. But I find this fascinating too, because when we think of books and like the whole thing of like, you don't judge a book by its cover, even though I totally do, we think that the only thing that matters is the story. The book is just a vehicle to the story, and the story is what matters. But you're also reminding us that there's a histories of the book. Like, there's a history of this material object that is part of a larger history with a capital H, right? Of how does the book come to be in terms of, like, the leather that is used to bind it, the pamphlets, like, who wrote them, who transported them, etc. But also the personal stories. Like, if you're having a paperback, like you were saying at the beginning, right? What's that book meant to somebody at a moment of their life? Was it a secret that they kept? Was it something that they proudly displayed in their bookshelf? Was it something that they had on a coffee table but they never read, right? It's a different ways that we connect to these physical objects beyond what's actually between the pages. And I think there's something very lovely of people reminding us that that also has value in terms of like the larger history of things, but also like our personal smaller histories. And I wonder if you find that also in antique shops, or if you go to a lot of like thrift shops or vintage shops, do you get also that sense of discovery? Because I think part of what this League of Extraordinary Gentlemen that are interested in books is a hunt, right? The sense of discovery for people's stories, but also objects themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this great antique shop / bookshop in Salado, Texas, or Salado, Texas, called Fletcher's. That guy is also really, really cool. But he deals in antiques. And so that's a realm that's completely different. I'm always fascinated by the amount of information that people know about very specific things.
Yeah,
I find that intriguing at a level. I deeply appreciate that level of knowledge. And I couldn't talk to you about a chair, you know, just, yeah. It just bore me. And even what I know about books, I don't know that much about books. Like, there are so many people that know, can differentiate between the different types of leathers and books. I think that the collector in the film found great significance in the story and the objects that he had. He saw the significance of the story behind the Baron. There was a woman who had the other cat, right?
Yes.
That he was like romantically interested in.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to meet.
Yeah.
But then the war happened.
Yeah.
And they were unable to meet. And he anticipated her visit for decades. And she just never came by. And the Baroness and the Baron never got to meet each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I can't speak for antique dealers, but I do think that anybody that deals with objects imbues them with stories as well, or tries to find some kind of greater significance other than the object itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about like places like Sotheby's that, or like these big auction houses, that seems to extract the more human story and sees it. If it's a valuable object, it now ceases to have story. And now it's just like this valuable thing. Sometimes it comes with a story, but then the story is just like secondary.
Mm-hmm.
I think whenever you go into like any regular antique shop, that's not like super, doesn't have like super, super valuable stuff, you're going to meet an antique dealer who knows some intricate story or special story about different items in the shop. And I think there's something beautiful about that.
Mm.
There's a lot of books in my bookstore that I can remember exactly who I bought them from.
Nice.
Or some like small little sliver of character that I can remember from the person that sold it to me. And if there's ever an opportunity for me to like tell that to somebody else, one of the top questions I get from people is, where do I get books from?
Uh-huh.
Like, where do I acquire my books? And there is this like innate curiosity to know where things come from.
Yeah.
It could be books. It could be, you know, that piano. there's a piano in the studio.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's like because we all want to be part of the tapestry of life. Mm-hmm. Like we like feeling connected. We like telling stories and hearing stories, especially if we buy something that is antique. We like to imagine, but also know what is behind. And I think it goes back to what you were saying of like the curiosity you had as a child, you know, of like understanding who were these people that live here? Why do they have peaches? Why mm-hmm. they go black? Yeah, I was, when you were speaking, I was thinking that I've always been very impressed that you are, I think you remember all of your books. I think I can ask you, like, which books do you have? And you're like, yeah, I already sold it. Or like, oh, I actually got it from here. Like, you know your books very well, and that's like supremely impressive. I was also curious too, since you know a lot about books, from watching this film, which book would you recommend to somebody that really liked this movie? Like, do you have any like cozy recommendations or... Like, if you like this, then read this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If somebody said that they really liked this film and they wanted, like, a recommendation, I would probably say Aesop's Fables.
Uh-huh.
I think Aesop's Fables are, like, very sweet and short. Some of them. There's something cozy about, like, fables, like animal tales. And I know she's, like, really intrigued by fairy tales, the protagonist. And I mean, Aesop's Fables aren't fairy tales or anything, but they kind of have like that magical element of animals talking. I love talking animals. I don't know why. It's just like, but yeah, I would recommend Aesop's Fables.
Do you have any stories of like when you were sad to part with a book, or do you have like a story of a book that you shared and you were very excited to share? Because when you were talking about this, I just got reminded of this. I remember my favorite thing that I bought from a vintage store is I have a picture in the shape of a penguin. Mm-hmm. It's great. I have a lot of animal theme kitchen utensils. And when we were paying for it, the lady on the counter is like, oh, goodbye, Victor. And it was like, who's Victor? It's like, oh, the picture is named Victor. It's like, oh, you're talking about Victoria. So another lady comes and they both had names for the penguin picture, but they were like a Victoria thing, so like the gender was unknown.
Yeah.
It was so great to see it.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh wow, somebody cared about this. Uh-huh. And that was mine.
That's awesome. I mean, there's only one thing that I can think of that I can remember. There's something sweet and sad about this moment that I had with this book. It was a book called The Art of Worldly Wisdom by Baltasar Gracián. He was this like 16th or 17th century Spanish monk. And there was a note inside of this particular copy of a son writing to his father and expressing that he knows his father doesn't usually like do this kind of thing with like notes or reading notes, and that he just wanted to tell his dad that he was having a good time in Mexico and that he ran into this book and it was a great book. And it's really changed his way of seeing some things, and that he would like to have a copy. And so he gifted him that copy with that note inside. And one thing that makes me sad sometimes with books is that whenever they're gifted to someone, the person sometimes doesn't appreciate it as much compared to like the person that gifted it. And sometimes maybe there is no like deep intent with the gifter who's gifting the book. But I think generally there is, and I don't know the story behind why the father gave up this book. I don't think the person that sold it to me was the father. It was a younger person who sold it to me. Or maybe it just was never delivered. I don't know.
Yeah.
But my initial instinct was, it's sad that I have this note. It's sad that I am carrying this emotion, this thought that this boy had and gifted it to his father, and now it's in my hands. And I thought that the father just gave the book away, or just, you know, got rid of the book, or maybe he never even read the note. I don't know. But then I thought, maybe it's not that, you know, maybe that's not what happened. Maybe what happened was the dad passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody got rid of the books and nobody thought to look inside the book to see that message there. I don't know. I'll never know.
Yeah.
But that's something that I carry with me. And I have the note. I kept the note.
I think this is like, It's such a beautiful story because, and I wonder about this a lot. There are certain things that we leave behind us that will outlive us. And there's also things that we write and that we think they're going to be forever and they disappear. Right, again, with the digital and the analog, the things are gone now in a second. Things are non-existent because they're non-material anymore. They're all digital, but the internet is forever. We live in a world of contradictions. It's weird how as humans, we try really hard to like live beyond our time. Yeah. And then sometimes that happens by design or by pure chance. Sometimes something we try really hard for it to be there forever is nonetheless gone. And I think that's also kind of part of what is very delightful of finding these objects in like used objects, antique objects, is something that kind of tells you that you are not the first person to live. You're not the first person to fall in love. You're not the first person to feel grief. And we're part of this like long history of humans trying to like figure each other out, figure ourselves out. Mm-hmm. I think that's also what's quite lovely of these chance encounters that happen, right? Like the chance encounter in the library in the film, right? That, oh yeah, somebody is taking the same books and it allows you for this imagination of why is that? Who is that? And there's something almost kind of nice of not knowing, of like being able to live in that memory or in that imagination.
Yeah.
It's very lovely talking to you, but we should shift to the rapid fire questions. Are you ready for your rapid fire questions?
Okay.
What is your favorite movie snack?
Oh, that's a good question. I have popcorn.
Okay. Yeah. Movie theater or streaming?
Movie theater.
Trailers or no spoilers?
Trailers.
Movie you would like to see again for the first time?
The Mummy.
Movie you watch way too young?
Dracula.
Which one?
It was called Dracula 2000.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't rewatched it, but I was terrified when I watched it for some reason.
One of your favorite movies?
Tarzan.
And one film that is required watching or that you think everybody should watch?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. Tarzan. Or you can't be the same.
Let's try another one.
The Aristocats.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I love the Aristocats.
I love the Aristocats. Spanish, they're
God, yes. Yeah. The Disney movies, like if you're a Spanish speaker, that you must listen to them, especially in Latin American Spanish. I cannot deal with the Spanish from Spain.
Yeah, I agree.
Disney in Spanish is amazing. Well, thank you so much, Seth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It was lovely.
Thanks, Ruby.
Thank you for listening to Watch Next. A huge thanks to our guests for joining us today, and to everyone at Lates and at UT Austin's College of Liberal Arts and the Department of Asian Studies for making this show possible. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss a conversation. Leave us a rating or a review to help other listeners discover the filmmakers and scholars we feature. New episodes drop every 2 weeks. Listen to Watch Next wherever you get your podcasts.